The literary world erupted when Jennifer L. Armentrout released A Fire in the Flesh, the third installment in her beloved Flesh and Fire series. This New York Times best-selling fantasy romance has captivated millions, with book talk creators generating billions of views discussing the steamy relationship between Serafina and Ash. The series has become a cultural phenomenon, with celebrities like Florence Pugh and Emma Roberts sharing their love for the books on social media. What makes this series particularly fascinating is Armentrout's personal journey. Diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa in 2015, she's become an advocate for blindness awareness while creating rich fantasy worlds that readers can lose themselves in. A Fire in the Flesh continues her tradition of blending high fantasy with sizzling romance, creating a reading experience that's as emotionally gripping as it is intellectually stimulating. At its core, A Fire in the Flesh explores the tension between destiny and choice. When we rejoin Serafina and Nyctos, Ash, they find themselves in dire circumstances, captured by Kolas, the false king of gods, after a shocking betrayal. This imprisonment sets the stage for a profound exploration of how much control we truly have over our lives. Serafina's entire existence has been defined by a prophecy and a duty to kill Kolas, the false primal of life. Yet as she struggles with this predetermined path, she begins to question whether she has any real agency. "I have choices, even when it feels like I don't," she realizes during a moment of clarity. This revelation becomes a turning point as she begins to see that even within the confines of fate, she can choose how she responds to her circumstances. Armentrout brilliantly weaves this philosophical question throughout the narrative. When Holland, revealed to be one of the RA, Fates, tells Serafina, "Every day there is a choice to keep going, to face the future head-on or not," he's articulating the novel's central theme, that even when larger forces seem to control our destiny, our responses to those forces remain our own. This theme resonates powerfully with readers because it reflects our own struggles with determinism versus free will. Like Serafina, we often feel constrained by circumstances beyond our control, family expectations, societal pressures, or biological limitations. Yet the novel suggests that true power comes not from escaping these constraints, but from choosing how we navigate within them. When Serafina decides to use Kolas's obsession with Satoria to her advantage, she's exercising agency within her limited options, a powerful metaphor for how we all must sometimes work within our constraints rather than futilely fighting against them. The novel also explores how our choices ripple outward, affecting others in ways we cannot always predict. Ash's decision to remove his cardia, heart, to protect himself from feeling love has consequences that extend far beyond his personal emotional state, ultimately threatening the balance of the realms. This interconnectedness reminds us that no choice exists in isolation. Our decisions, however personal, create ripples that touch countless other lives. Kolas's realm operates as a chilling metaphor for authoritarian regimes throughout human history. His rule is maintained through a combination of fear, manipulation, and the careful control of information, tactics that will feel uncomfortably familiar to readers aware of real-world political dynamics. The novel presents a nuanced exploration of how power corrupts. Kolas wasn't always the monster he became. As Callum reveals, he was better than that before Aethos died. This glimpse into Kolas's past adds complexity to his character, suggesting that his tyranny stems not from inherent evil, but from grief and betrayal that twisted his nature over time. This transformation serves as a warning about how unchecked power, combined with emotional trauma, can corrupt even those who once possessed goodness. Particularly disturbing is Kolas's treatment of the Chosen, mortals raised from birth to serve in Elysium. These individuals have no agency over their fate, raised with the singular purpose of serving gods who view them as disposable. The scene where Kolas forces Jove to undergo ascension is especially unsettling, as it reveals how completely the Chosen have been indoctrinated to view their own exploitation as an honor. "It is an honor," Jove says, though his trembling voice betrays his fear. this system parallels many historical instances where ruling classes maintained power by convincing the oppressed that their subjugation was natural, necessary, or even beneficial. When Serafina witnesses a god assaulting a chosen and attempts to intervene, she's confronting not just an individual act of cruelty, but an entire system built on exploitation. The politics of Colas's court further illustrate how authoritarian regimes operate. His public punishment of Evander serves not just to discipline one individual, but to remind everyone of the consequences of displeasing him. When he manipulates Serafina into killing Evander, then reveals she was misled, it's a demonstration of his absolute control. He can make even those who oppose him complicit in his cruelty. This political dimension adds depth to what might otherwise be a straightforward fantasy romance. Through Colas's realm, Armantrout invites readers to consider how power structures in our own world might similarly manipulate, indoctrinate, and control, and what responsibility we have to resist such systems, even when resistance seems futile. Trauma shapes nearly every character in A Fire in the Flesh, but none more profoundly than Serafina herself. Having spent her entire life being trained as a weapon, enduring emotional abuse from her mother, and surviving sexual assault at the hands of Tavius, Serafina carries deep psychological wounds that influence her every interaction. Armantrout handles these traumas with remarkable sensitivity, never exploiting them for shock value, but instead showing how they inform Serafina's character development. Particularly powerful is Serafina's reaction to being forced into Colas's bathtub. Having been nearly choked to death in a bathtub has tainted what used to be a luxury. This simple observation captures how trauma transforms even mundane experiences into potential triggers. The novel also explores different survival mechanisms. Serafina's ability to become a blank canvas, emptying herself of emotion to endure difficult situations, is a dissociative response common among trauma survivors. I become an empty vessel once more, a blank canvas down to my bones, suitable and ready to become whoever I needed to be, she thinks when faced with Colas's demands. This coping mechanism has helped her survive, but the novel also shows its limitations, how it disconnects her from herself and others. Ash's trauma manifests differently. His removal of his cardia represents an extreme attempt to protect himself from emotional pain after losing his mother. Rather than becoming blank, he's built walls of sarcasm and detachment. These different responses illustrate how individuals develop unique strategies to survive their wounds. What makes the novel's treatment of trauma particularly nuanced is its recognition that healing isn't linear or simple. When Ash helps Serafina feel comfortable bathing again by standing guard, it's a small but significant step toward recovery. Yet other traumas remain unresolved, continuing to influence their behaviors and relationships. This reflects the reality of trauma recovery. It's ongoing work rather than a destination reached. The relationship between Serafina and Ash offers a hopeful perspective on healing. Their connection doesn't magically erase their traumas, but it does provide a safe space where they can begin to process them. When Ash assures Serafina that she can trust him with her body after her experience with Colas, it's a powerful moment of healing through connection. "I will do anything you ask of me, Sarah," he promises, giving her complete control over their intimacy. This portrayal of trauma and recovery resonates with readers because it acknowledges both the lasting impact of psychological wounds and the possibility of healing through healthy relationships and personal agency. It suggests that while we cannot erase our past traumas, we can learn to carry them differently, integrating them into our stories without allowing them to define us completely. Throughout A Fire in the Flesh, Armantrout explores the fundamental duality of existence, how opposing forces not only contrast with each other, but depend on each other for meaning and balance. This philosophical concept is embodied most literally in the relationship between life and death, personified by Serafina and Ash. "There must always be death and vice versa," Colas explains. "Just as every action has a reaction, one cannot exist without the other. This balance isn't just metaphorical, but literal within the novel's cosmology. Without both the primal of life and the primal of death, the realms would collapse. This interdependence of seemingly opposite forces echoes philosophical concepts from Taoism to Hegelianism, suggesting that apparent opposites are actually complementary aspects of a greater whole. This duality extends beyond life and death to other opposing concepts throughout the novel. Light and shadow, creation and destruction, love and hate, all are presented not as simple binaries, but as interconnected forces that define each other. When Ash tells Serafina, "I never felt alive until you," it's a powerful acknowledgement of how death finds meaning through life. The novel also explores how these dualities exist within individuals. Serafina carries both the embers of life and the potential for destruction. Ash, though the primal of death, nurtures and protects. Even Colas, ostensibly the primal of life, brings primarily death and suffering. These internal contradictions suggest that the boundaries between opposing forces are more permeable than they might appear. Perhaps most significantly, the novel examines the duality of love itself, how the same emotion that brings the greatest joy can also cause the deepest pain. Colas's twisted obsession with Satoria began as love, but warped into something destructive. Ash removed his cardia precisely because he feared the pain that comes with loving deeply. Yet Serafina and Ash's relationship demonstrates how true love embraces both the pleasure and the pain, the vulnerability and the strength. This exploration of duality offers readers a profound meditation on the nature of existence. Rather than presenting a simplistic view where good and evil are clearly delineated, Armantrout creates a world of moral complexity where light and shadow coexist in every character and situation. This nuanced perspective invites readers to consider the dualities in their own lives, how joy and sorrow, strength and vulnerability, creation and destruction might not be opposing forces, but complementary aspects of a complete human experience. In a genre often criticized for romanticizing toxic relationships, Armantrout offers a refreshingly mature exploration of what constitutes genuine love. Through the contrasting relationships of Serafina slash Ash and Satoria slash Colas, the novel distinguishes between healthy love and dangerous obsession. A pivotal moment comes when Serafina explains to Colas the difference between loving someone and being in love. Loving someone isn't less than being in love. It's just not as strong or as irrevocable. Loving someone can change. It can grow into being in love, and it can fade. Being in love, it doesn't do that. It only gets stronger, and you would do anything for that person. Anything. Being in love it's unbreakable. This distinction isn't just romantic philosophy. It has practical implications for how characters treat each other. Colas claims to love Satoria, yet his love manifests as possession, control, and entitlement. He believes his feelings give him the right to dominate her completely, regardless of her own desires. When he tells Serafina, "I killed my brother to bring you back to life," he presents this as the ultimate proof of love, failing to recognize the selfishness underlying his actions. In stark contrast, Ash's love for Serafina is characterized by respect for her autonomy. Even when he disagrees with her choices, he acknowledges her right to make them. When she insists on freeing his father's soul despite the risk to herself, he protests but ultimately respects her decision. His love is expressed not through control, but through support, protection, and a willingness to be vulnerable. The novel also explores how true love requires seeing the other person completely rather than projecting one's own desires onto them. Colas doesn't love Serafina. He loves the idea of Satoria that he's projected onto her. Ash, however, loves Serafina for who she truly is, including her stubbornness, temper, and complexity. "I see you, Sarah," he tells her repeatedly throughout their relationship. Perhaps most powerfully, the novel suggests that true love isn't about grand gestures or passionate declarations, but about the small, consistent ways we show up for each other. When Ash stands guard so Serafina can bathe without fear, or when he asks for her consent before every intimate touch after her experience with Colas, he's demonstrating love through everyday actions that honor her needs and boundaries. This nuanced portrayal of love resonates with readers because it moves beyond the simplistic love conquers all narrative common in romance. Instead, it presents love as a complex, evolving connection that requires ongoing work, communication, and mutual respect. When Ash and Serafina finally come together as equals, both primals with their own power and agency, their relationship models the kind of partnership many readers aspire to, one based not on dependency or dominance, but on mutual growth and support. Who are we when stripped of the identities others have assigned to us? This question lies at the heart of Serafina's journey throughout A Fire in the Flesh. Having spent her entire life defined by her purpose, to kill Colas, she faces an identity crisis when Attes reveals she isn't the weapon she was raised to be. "I felt like a huge part of my identity had been shattered," she reflects. This moment of crisis forces her to confront a profound question: who is she beyond her assigned purpose? The answer emerges gradually as she makes choices that reflect her own values rather than others' expectations. This theme of self-definition through choice resonates throughout the novel. Ash, too, struggles with questions of identity. Is he defined by his role as primal of death? By his relationship to Colas? By the absence of his cardia? When he chooses to prioritize Serafina over his duties, declaring, "The lives of millions of mortals, nor those of the gods, do not surpass yours," he's asserting his right to define himself through his own choices, rather than through his predetermined role. Even secondary characters grapple with questions of identity. Callum's entire sense of self is built around his failure to protect Satoria and his subsequent loyalty to Colas. Elias must decide whether his identity is defined by his oath to the King of Gods or by his own moral compass. These parallel journeys emphasize that identity formation is a universal struggle. The novel also explores how our identities are shaped by our relationships with others. Serafina begins to see herself differently through Ash's eyes, not as a weapon or a vessel, but as someone worthy of love and respect. This mirrors how our own self-perceptions are influenced by how we're seen by those who truly know us. Perhaps most significantly, the novel suggests that our identities aren't fixed, but constantly evolving through our choices. When Serafina decides to fight for Ash's freedom despite the risk to herself, she's not just making a tactical decision, but a statement about who she is, someone who values love over self-preservation. These accumulating choices gradually form a coherent self that transcends the roles others have assigned to us by others. This exploration of identity through choice speaks powerfully to readers navigating their own questions of self-definition. In a world where we're often defined by our jobs, relationships, or social roles, the novel affirms our right to define ourselves through our own values and choices. Serafina's journey suggests that even when external forces seem to dictate who we are, our responses to those forces, what we choose to sacrifice, fight for, or protect, ultimately define us more authentically than any label or role assigned to us by others. In a realm built on hierarchy, isolation, and fear, genuine connection becomes a revolutionary act. Throughout A Fire in the Flesh, Armantrout explores how authentic relationships threaten systems of oppression by creating bonds that transcend imposed divisions. Colas's entire regime depends on keeping people separated and distrustful. The Chosen are veiled and forbidden from speaking to gods except when serving them. Gods who displease Colas are publicly punished to discourage solidarity. Even the primals are kept at odds with each other through manipulation and selective information. These tactics mirror real-world authoritarian strategies that maintain power by preventing the formation of community bonds that might challenge the status quo. Against this backdrop, every genuine connection becomes an act of resistance. When Serafina speaks directly to the Chosen or shows concern for their welfare, she's rejecting the hierarchical system that renders them invisible. When she forms an alliance with Attis, despite their complicated history, she's building bridges that Colas has tried to destroy. These connections gradually form a network of resistance that ultimately enables her escape. Most revolutionary is Serafina's connection with Ash, which defies the ancient division between life and death. Their relationship, eventually revealed as that of Mates of the Heart, represents a fundamental challenge to the established order. The one thing more powerful than the Array, Serafina realizes, is true love of heart and soul. This connection doesn't just bring personal fulfillment, it literally reshapes the realms, healing the rot and restoring balance. The novel also explores how connection requires vulnerability, another revolutionary act in a world where vulnerability is exploited. When Ash admits to Serafina that he loves her despite his missing Cardia, he's making himself vulnerable in a way that defies everything he's been taught about power and control. This willingness to be vulnerable ultimately proves more powerful than Colas's attempts to dominate through force. This theme resonates with readers because it speaks to our fundamental human need for connection and our intuitive understanding that authentic relationships can transform not just individual lives, but entire social systems. In our increasingly divided world, the novel's suggestion that connection across differences can heal collective wounds offers a hopeful vision of how personal relationships might contribute to broader social healing. The boundary between mortal and divine realms forms a fascinating frontier in A Fire in the Flesh. Rather than presenting these worlds as entirely separate, Armantrout explores their complex interconnection, how events in one realm ripple into the other, and how individuals navigate the liminal spaces between. Serafina herself embodies this intersection. Born mortal but carrying the embers of a primal, she exists at the crossroads of humanity and divinity. Her unique position gives her insights that pure mortals or gods lack. She understands both the value of mortal life and the responsibilities of divine power. When she challenges Colas's dismissive attitude toward mortals, arguing that most spend their time trying to survive, she's bridging a perspective gap between realms. The novel also explores how the divine realm impacts mortal lives, often without mortals' knowledge or consent. The rot spreading through Lasagna is a direct consequence of the imbalance between the primal of life and death. The gods' demands for offerings and worship affect mortal economies and social structures. These connections suggest that the separation between realms is more permeable than it appears. What happens among the gods matters profoundly for mortal existence. This intersection creates unique ethical questions. What responsibilities do divine beings have toward mortals? When Colas dismisses mortal suffering as of their own making, he's abdicating any divine responsibility toward human welfare. In contrast, Ash's concern for the people of the Shadowlands suggests a more compassionate perspective on the divine-mortal relationship. The novel also examines how power disparities complicate interactions across this boundary. When gods enter the mortal realm, they bring powers that fundamentally alter the dynamics of consent and choice. The Ascended, who feed on mortals, turning them into craven, represent the darkest version of this power imbalance, divine power used to exploit rather than protect. Perhaps most interestingly, the novel suggests that the boundary between mortal and divine isn't fixed but fluid. Serafina's transformation from mortal to primal demonstrates that these categories aren't absolute. This fluidity challenges hierarchical thinking that places gods permanently above mortals, suggesting instead a more cyclical relationship, where mortals can become divine and divine beings can learn from mortal experiences. This exploration of intersecting realms offers readers a metaphorical framework for considering how different worlds collide in our own lives, how global events affect local communities, how the powerful impact the vulnerable, or how different cultural spheres interact and transform each other. By portraying these intersections with nuance rather than simplistic boundaries, Armantrout invites readers to consider the complex webs of influence that connect seemingly separate domains of experience. The climactic sequence of A Fire in the Flesh centers on a profound sacrifice. Serafina's willingness to die so that Ash can take the embers of life and restore balance to the realms. This sacrifice transcends simple heroism, exploring deeper questions about what gives life meaning and what we're willing to die for. Serafina's choice isn't made lightly. She's acutely aware of what she's giving up: a future with Ash, the chance to experience the love she's only recently discovered, the opportunity to see the Shadowlands heal under their joint rule. Yet she chooses sacrifice because she values something more than her individual happiness: the well-being of countless others who would suffer if the rot continued to spread. What makes this sacrifice particularly powerful is that it's not abstract or impersonal. Serafina isn't dying for an ideology or a distant cause, but for specific people she's come to care about: Ash, Ios, Belle, Rain, Jadis, Reaver, and countless others whose lives would be destroyed by the continuing rot. This personal dimension transforms her sacrifice from mere duty to an act of profound love. The novel also explores how sacrifice is interpreted differently depending on perspective. From Serafina's viewpoint, her death is necessary for the greater good. From Ash's perspective, no greater good could possibly justify losing her. When he declares, "The lives of millions of mortals, nor those of the gods, do not surpass yours," he's rejecting utilitarian ethics in favor of a more personal moral framework centered on love and loyalty. This conflict between individual love and collective welfare raises profound ethical questions. Is Serafina right to sacrifice herself for the many, or is Ash right to prioritize her life above all others? The novel doesn't offer a simple answer, instead presenting both perspectives as understandable within their own frameworks. This moral complexity elevates the story beyond a simple tale of heroic sacrifice. Ultimately, the novel suggests that the dichotomy between individual love and collective good might be false. When Ash's blood saves Serafina and she ascends as the true primal of life, their love doesn't come at the expense of the realms, but actually heals them. The rot recedes and life begins returning to the Shadowlands. This resolution suggests that sometimes the deepest personal connections can create ripples of healing that extend far beyond the individuals involved. This theme of sacrifice transformed by love resonates with readers because it speaks to our deepest questions about what makes life meaningful. In a world that often feels chaotic and overwhelming, the novel suggests that our willingness to sacrifice for those we love, and sometimes others' refusal to accept our sacrifice, creates meaning that transcends our individual existence. When Rain and the others honor Serafina with their blood oath before her apparent final journey, they're acknowledging how her willingness to sacrifice has transformed not just the realms, but their understanding of courage and love. A Fire in the Flesh concludes with a powerful message about finding hope even in the darkest circumstances. Throughout the novel, characters face seemingly insurmountable challenges: imprisonment, betrayal, impending death, yet somehow find reasons to continue fighting, loving, and hoping. This theme is embodied in the physical transformation of the Shadowlands. Initially described as a realm of perpetual twilight where nothing grows, by the novel's end, we see patches of grass sprouting where there was once only barren earth. This visual representation of life returning to barren places mirrors the emotional journeys of the characters, who find new beginnings where they expected only endings. Serafina's journey particularly exemplifies this theme. Raised to believe her death was inevitable and necessary, she finds herself unexpectedly reborn as the primal of life. Her transformation suggests that even when all paths seem to lead to darkness, unexpected light can emerge. When she realizes the rot has been stopped, both in the Shadowlands and the mortal realm, it's a powerful affirmation that healing is possible even after centuries of damage. The novel also explores how hope often requires community. Serafina doesn't find her way to rebirth alone. She's supported by Ash's love, Atessa's knowledge, Kahela's assistance, and the loyalty of many others. This collective dimension of hope challenges individualistic narratives of heroism, suggesting instead that we find our way through darkness by supporting each other. Perhaps most significantly, the novel suggests that hope isn't about denying darkness, but about finding meaning within it. When Nectis tells Serafina that life was worth living even when unfair, he's not dismissing suffering, but acknowledging that rewards could be found among the chores, little pieces of enjoyment. This nuanced perspective offers readers a model of hope that doesn't depend on perfect circumstances, but on finding value even within imperfection. The unexpected love between Ash and Serafina, defying even the removal of his cardia, serves as the novel's most powerful symbol of hope emerging from unlikely places. Their connection as mates of the heart represents something unprecedented, a bond so powerful it can snap a thread prematurely or extend one through sheer will. This suggests that even within systems as ancient and seemingly fixed as fate itself, new possibilities can emerge. This message of hope resonates particularly powerfully because it doesn't come cheap. The characters earn their hopeful ending through genuine suffering, difficult choices, and painful growth. When Ash and Serafina finally come together as equals, both primals with their full power, it's not a fairy tale ending that erases caste trauma, but a hard-won new beginning that acknowledges the scars they'll always carry. In a world often overwhelmed by cynicism and despair, this authentic but uncompromising hope offers readers a template for finding their own reasons to continue, even when circumstances seem darkest. Like the grass sprouting in the Shadowlands, the novel suggests new life can emerge in the most unexpected places, if we remain open to its possibility.